is the question of the nature of truth. Now, there are two views of truth today. One is a correspondence view and one is a non-correspondence view. The correspondence view of truth says the basis of truth is factual. The non-correspondence view says it's practical. The correspondence view says the referent, that to which truth refers, is reality. The non-correspondence view says truth is the result. Does it work? What comes about as a result of it? The medium of truth for the correspondence is expressions or language. A statement is true or false. An expression is true or false. Or the medium of truth for non-correspondence is experience, life. It's a true experience. The location of truth for the correspondence is in an affirmation. You either affirm or deny something. But the location of truth for the non-correspondence view is in intention. Have you ever heard somebody say, well, let's get back at the intention of the author? Now, that's a very dangerous statement because it can mean two or three things. It can mean intention in the mind of the author behind the Bible, or it can mean intention of the author expressed in the Bible. Now, if it means the latter, fine. If it means the former, then we're no longer exegetes, we're psychoanalysts. You have to psychoanalyze the mind of Paul rather than exegete the page of Corinthians or Romans. So be very careful with this word intention. It's a troublesome word. It's caused us more problems. And the so-called intentionalist view of truth says that if you intend it to be true, it is true. On that view, every sincere statement ever made is true. Because every sincere person intended to be saying the truth. Go north as a statement that was wrong when you should have been going south, if it was intended to be true, was true, even though you're sending the person in the wrong direction. Now notice the nature of error. According to the correspondence view of truth, the nature of error is a falsehood or a mistake. But according to the non-correspondence view, it's not an error unless it's an intentional deception, which is a lie. So they're saying, in essence, there are no lies in the Bible, but there are mistakes in the Bible. Because God would never intentionally mislead anyone. He just happened to make some mistakes when he was intentionally trying to lead them to heaven. That's why they can believe the Bible has mistakes in it, but if you ask them, are there errors in the Bible, some will say no. Because they're defining error differently. By error, they mean the Bible never deceives you. If you follow it, it will always lead you to heaven. For us, correspondence view, all mistakes are errors. For them, not all mistakes are errors. Only the big ones are errors, because only the big mistakes will mislead you. That's why Fuller Seminary, when they answered Harold Lindzell's book, The Battle for the Bible, in their theological news and notes, said, the Bible as a whole is true, but some of the parts are false. That's called new math. The whole is not equal to the sum of the parts. You can have errant parts and an inerrant whole. So the Bible as a whole is without error, but there are many errors in the parts of the Bible. It's very tricky, and the whole debate really seems to resolve around what is truth. Is truth what corresponds to reality, or is truth just simply what you intend to accomplish, even though there's some mistakes in it? All right, let's move on now to talk about truth as correspondence. We've already given the reasons why we hold that truth must be defined as that which corresponds to reality. To put it in everyday language, truth is telling it like it is. Reality is, but an expression about reality is true or it's false. If the expression accurately portrays the reality, then it's true. If it doesn't, it's false. I'd like to give several arguments in favor of the correspondence view of truth. First of all, the biblical arguments, and then some philosophical arguments. The biblical arguments go as follows. The ninth commandment is predicated on a correspondence view of truth. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Exodus 20, verse 16. This very commandment depends for its meaning and its effectiveness on a correspondence view of truth. This command implies that a statement is false if it does not correspond to reality. Indeed, this is precisely how the term lie is used in Scripture. A lie is something that doesn't correspond to reality, which you intentionally say. Satan is called a liar, John 8:44, because his statement to Eve, "You will surely not die," Genesis 3:4, did not correspond to what God really said, namely, "You shall surely die," Genesis 2:17. Ananias and Sapphira lied to the apostles, to the Holy Spirit, by misrepresenting the factual state of affairs about their finances in Acts 5:1-4. So the lie there was something that did not correspond to reality. If it does correspond to reality, it's true. The Bible gives numerous examples of the correspondence view of truth. For example, Joseph said to his brothers, "Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth." And by truth he meant, did their statement correspond to reality? When they talked about his father back home and his brother back home, he wanted to make sure the statement corresponded to reality to know if it was true. Moses commanded that false prophets be tested on the grounds that if what a prophet proclaims does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has not spoken. If the message corresponded to reality, it was true. If it didn't, it was false. Solomon prayed at the dedication of the temple, "And now, O God of Israel, let your word that you promised your servant David my father, that there would be a temple, come true." 1 Kings 8:26. That would be the way to test whether it was true, if it came to pass. The prophecies of Micaiah were considered true, and the false prophet's words lies, because the former corresponded with the facts of reality. 1 Kings 22:16-22. Something was considered a falsehood if it did not correspond to God's law. Psalm 119:163. Proverbs states, "A truthful witness saves lives, but a false witness is deceitful." Proverbs 14:25. Which implies that truth is factually correct. In short, intentions alone will not save innocent lives in a courtroom. Only the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth will do it. So when you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, you couldn't be saying, "I swear to speak with good intentions on every topic." What you swear to do is to represent reality as you saw it. Nebuchadnezzar demanded of his wise men to know the facts, and he considered anything else misleading, Daniel 2:9. Jesus' statement in John 5:33 entails a correspondence view of truth. "You have sent to John, and he has testified to the truth." What John said really represents what I am. Acts 24, there's an unmistakable usage of a correspondence view of truth. The Jews said to the governor about Paul, quote, "By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him." Verse 8. They continued, "You can easily verify the facts." Verse 11. So they implied a correspondence view of truth by saying, if you want to know that what we're saying is true, just look at the facts to which these statements refer. Paul clearly implied a correspondence view of truth when he wrote, "Each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to his neighbor," Ephesians 4:25. Now, on the other side, the biblical use of the word error does not support the intentionalist theory of truth, since it is used of unintentional errors. In Leviticus 4:2 and 4:27 and a number of other places, there was a sacrifice, a guilt offering, for unintentional errors. Now, if an error had to be intentional to be an error, then there would be no such thing as an unintentional error. But the very fact that there were sacrifices for unintentional errors shows that the concept of error does not necessarily entail the concept of intention. You can give an unintentional falsehood. Certain acts are wrong, whether the trespasser intended to commit them or not, and hence a guilt offering was called for to atone for their error. Now let me summarize. The Bible consistently employs a correspondence view of truth. A statement is true if it corresponds to the facts, and false if it does not. Rarely are there even any apparent exceptions to this. Now let me note an apparent exception to this. John chapter 14 and verse 6, Jesus said, "I am the truth." And on the basis of this, some say, see, he's not referring to a correspondence view of truth. He thinks truth is personal. He as a person is the truth. I think that's a misunderstanding of what correspondence means. Let's suppose this is the reality here, and we say over here is a statement that corresponds to the reality. Then here is a gesture that corresponds to reality. Here is a person who corresponds to reality, and here is an activity or an act. There are many different things that correspond to reality. It doesn't have to be a statement to correspond to reality. We stress statements or propositions because the Bible is a propositional or statement type revelation. But gestures correspond to reality, and so do persons. So when Jesus said, "I am the truth," he meant that he corresponds to the Father. He is the Logos that represents the Theos. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. And if you look at me, said Jesus, you have seen the Father, because I correspond to him. My thoughts correspond to his thoughts. My deeds correspond to his deeds. Everything I think and do because the Father first thought it and did it, and I'm living in obedience to him. So the very fact that Jesus referred to his person as being true doesn't mean that truth is personal. It just means that a person can correspond to the ultimate reality just the way a proposition, a gesture, or an activity can correspond to reality. All of truth is correspondence. What corresponds may be more than sentences. Could be gestures, persons, or activities, as well as sentences. There are, to my knowledge, no exceptions to this, that this view of truth covers everything in the Bible. I will say this, that the Bible concept of truth is broader than correspondence, but it is not narrower than correspondence. That is, you will never find a concept of truth in the Bible that negates correspondence, but you will find that truth in the Bible means more than correspondence. If you do a word study of the Hebrew and Greek words for truth, you will find out that truth also has a kind of faithfulness to it, that God is faithful to his promise, as well as the promise corresponding to reality. So there are other dimensions to truth than correspondence, but there is no truth that doesn't correspond. That leads us to the next comment here. If the biblical arguments are this strong for a correspondence view of truth, why is it that many Christians, even some who believe in inerrancy, claim to hold a non-correspondence or intentional view of truth? It seems to me the answer is quite simple. There is a confusion between theory of truth and test for truth. Everybody should believe a correspondence theory of truth, but not everyone tests the truth statements in the same way. Or to put it in perhaps more precise language, everyone should define truth the same way, even if they defend the truth of that statement differently. As a matter of fact, I believe in defending the truth of statements in different ways. How would you go about defending the truth of this statement? Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Now, if you're making a historical affirmation, as I am with that statement, you would want to defend the truth of that by looking into the historical evidence of Christ living and dying and rising from the dead. But how would you defend the truth of this statement? This is the best pie I have ever eaten. I suppose that you would want to take that pie and taste it for yourself, that no historical arguments analyzing pie tasters would be sufficient. You would want to taste the pie for yourself. The proof of the pie is in the eating, to paraphrase an old English proverb. So you test truth in different ways, but truth never means different things. Truth always means that which corresponds to reality. Even if you test it pragmatically, existentially, historically, or rationally, just to mention four ways different kinds of truth statements could be tested. In summary, there are good reasons for insisting that correspondence theory of truth should be accepted regardless of the apologetic debate of how Christians should test their truth statements. I'm not going into the intramural apologetic debate here as to whose apologetic system is right in defending truth. I'm just suggesting that whether you're a presuppositionalist or a non-presuppositionalist, we should all define the truth in the same way, even if we want to defend it differently. Okay, now arguments. Basically, I'm saying here that the Bible, although it may not formally teach a correspondence view of truth, directly implies a correspondence view of truth in the Ten Commandments, in its affirmations about prophecy, and in numerous statements in the Bible about the nature of what truth and error are. Now, Jack Rogers holds an intentionalist view of truth, and I'm intentionally discussing this for that very reason, to show that Jack Rogers' theory of truth is wrong, and therefore his whole view of biblical inerrancy is wrong. Yes, Jack Rogers says, 2 Timothy 3:15 says, the Bible is able to make you wise unto salvation. That's the intention or purpose of the Bible. As long as the Bible accomplishes that purpose in your life, doesn't matter whether there are some things that don't correspond to reality. As long as that crude map I made for you to go to Houston gets you to Houston, don't worry that I have roads in the wrong places and misspelled words in it. The whole thing is whether my intention to get you to Houston accomplished its purpose. Philosophical arguments for a correspondence view of truth. First of all, lies would be impossible without a correspondence view of truth. If one statement need not correspond to the facts in order to be true, then any factually incorrect statement could be true. And if this is the case, then lies become impossible because any statement is compatible with any given state of affairs. See, unless the statement has to correspond to reality to be true, and not simply be what you intend in good faith to be true, then anything could be true, as long as you intend it in good faith. As long as you're sincere, everything would be true. Because if you sincerely make the statement, believing that it corresponds to reality, even if it doesn't, and if your sincerity or intention is the only thing that counts in testing its truthfulness, then the statement could indeed not correspond to the facts and still be true. So any statement could be made about any state of affairs which may or may not correspond to the state of affairs, and the statement would be true simply because of its intention. So it would literally make lies impossible. It would make lying impossible if you held to an intentionalist view of truth. Secondly, go through all of these. First, without correspondence, there could be no such thing as truth or falsity. In order to know something is true as opposed to something that is false, there must be a real difference between things and the statement about the things. But this real difference between thought and thing is precisely what is entailed in a correspondence view of truth. If there is no difference between your thought and the things, then whatever you think would automatically be true. You have to have a thing and thought about a thing. And your thought about the thing either corresponds or it doesn't correspond. If you don't have a thing, but it's just your thought, regardless of thing, then your thoughts would always just automatically be true. So in order to have such a thing as truth and falsity, you have to have thing and thought and correspondence between thing and thought, or there wouldn't be any truth or falsity at all. Thirdly, factual communications, and in that sense, all communications, because I believe that you can prove that all communications are probably reducible to or dependent on some kind of factual communication. That there is no real communication of any content that doesn't involve some factual communication at the core. And if you could prove that, then you could say all communication, not just factual communication, would break down without a correspondence view of truth. Factual communication depends on information or informative statements. But informative statements must be factually true. That is, they must correspond to the facts in order to inform one correctly. Further, since all communication seems to depend ultimately on something being literally or factually true, then it would follow that all communication depends in the final analysis on a correspondence view of truth. The reason being, you cannot say this is a metaphor unless you know what is literally true, because you're saying this is not literal depends on your knowing what is literally true. So if even the non-literal depends on a literal being true, then all statements, even metaphorical statements, would depend on a correspondence view of truth, that this is literally true about that. Fourthly, even the intentionalist theory of truth depends on a correspondence view of truth. There's no way that Jack Rogers or Birkhauer or Karl Barth or Emil Brunner or any of the other bees buzzing around the theological circuit could even hold their intentionalist view of truth if the correspondence view of truth weren't correct. Because the intentionalist theory claims something is true only if it accomplishes that which corresponded to the intentions. See, if the Bible's intention is to save people, then how do you know if the Bible is true? If it accomplishes its intention of saving people. Now, you have the saving people here and the Bible's intention here. So the Bible's intention would have to correspond to that result in order for you to know the Bible is true. So even the intentionalist view of truth, as held by Jack Rogers, depends on a correspondence of the intention to the reality, in this corresponding to results or corresponding to reality. Harold Lindzell came out with a book. His book was The Battle for the Bible. In the book, he said that Fuller Seminary had deviated from the historic position on inerrancy, and he mentioned a number of factual things, one of which was that while the Fuller professors were signing the statement in inerrancy, many of them didn't believe it because they changed it and dropped it out of the statement saying they no longer believed it. And Lindzell thought that was a little inconsistent because they were signing it, supposedly believing it, while they didn't believe it, which is the reason they changed it, because they didn't believe it. And he mentioned a number of other things that did not make Fuller happy. Fuller responded in its Theological News and Notes, which is its alumni paper, in which David Hubbard and a number of professors said various things about Lindzell, one of which was that Lindzell made a handful of errors when he spoke about Fuller. Now just analyze what that statement means for a moment, and you'll see that what Hubbard was saying is that Lindzell's statements did not correspond to reality. He gave a handful of errors of things that Lindzell said that did not accurately represent the state of affairs at Fuller. Now, let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that Hubbard is right. Doesn't matter whether he's right or wrong. And ask ourselves, how could Hubbard make a statement like this, that Lindzell is wrong and he made a number of errors, without implying a correspondence theory of truth? Because in order to say Lindzell's statements were wrong, he implied they did not correspond to reality. But to say his statements did not correspond to reality is to imply a correspondence view of truth. But the irony is this: Hubbard doesn't believe a correspondence view of truth. He believes, as the title of his book puts, the Bible that works. As long as the Bible works in your life and produces salvation, it doesn't matter whether all the statements correspond to reality. So here we have one of the great ironies of the inerrancy debate. Hubbard, who doesn't believe in a correspondence view of truth, and that's why he doesn't believe in inerrancy, criticizes Lindzell, who does believe in a correspondence view of truth, but the very basis for Hubbard's criticism is a correspondence view of truth. But he had to imply a correspondence view of truth even to criticize Lindzell. But if he had held a correspondence view of truth to begin with, he would have been on Lindzell's side. Because if you hold a correspondence view of truth, you would have held the inerrancy position as opposed to the non-correspondence view of truth, which is the non-inerrancy position. So there's no way to escape the need for using a correspondence view of truth. Let's take this statement. A correspondence view of truth is wrong. Now, if you make that statement, a correspondence view of truth is wrong, either that statement corresponds to reality or it doesn't. If it corresponds to reality, it's true. But if it's true, it's false. Because if it corresponds to reality, it proves a correspondence view of truth is correct. If it doesn't correspond to reality, the statement is false. You can't escape a correspondence view of truth because you have to make the statement that a correspondence view of truth is false, in which statement you use a correspondence view of truth to state that the correspondence view of truth is false. undeniable. The most important thing you can learn out of this or any other class, in my opinion, that has to do with looking for error or getting out your spiritual Geiger counter, or as somebody put it recently, geyser counter. The most important thing you can do is just state the view clearly. And if in stating the view, it denies the view, if in affirming the view, you deny it, if in denying the view, you affirm it, then it's inescapable what the truth is. Because you cannot say, meaningfully, I cannot utter a word in English without uttering a word in English. You cannot say, no statements apply to God unless some statements apply to God. You cannot say, the correspondent's view of truth is wrong unless your statement corresponds to reality. All right, good question. Would someone like David Hubbard apply his view only to matters of Scripture across the board to everything in life? If you think about that for a moment, you have to conclude that he couldn't eat, he couldn't go to the men's room, he couldn't go out a door that said exit on it unless he held a correspondent's view of truth. You know, you can't pick up Campbell's chicken noodle soup in the store unless you believe a correspondent's view of truth. Because that label, you assume, corresponds to the contents. If you had to pragmatically test all the contents, open it up in the store, you can see that would cause some difficulty. If an exit sign means enter, if women's restroom doesn't mean that, it can be very embarrassing for men. If, you know, and on and on and on, just through out life, I would say that practically speaking, you have to use it in all of your commerce in life. Now, they can always say, yes, but religious truth is different. Religious truth is existential. Religious truth is personal. Religious truth. And then you just have to say to them, wait a second. Here, you know. Who told you it's different? And how can you say it's different without implying a correspondence view of truth yourself when you're saying it's different? How do you get this arbitrary choice? All other truth is this way, but truth no longer means that when I apply it to the Bible. Why don't you just be honest and say we're no longer talking about truth? We're talking about liver quivers and leaps of faith and gut level tremors or I feel the force. But we're no longer talking about truth. And I don't mind people doing that. I mean, we all make emotive statements like, ouch. I don't affirm any truth necessarily by a statement, ouch. I just emote a feeling. But are we only emoting feelings when we say God exists, Jesus is the Son of God, the way to salvation is through Christ? Is that just emotive language? Is that just evocative, ejaculative language? Or are we really describing something? So I think they're either arbitrary or self-defeating in not applying a correspondence view of truth straight across the board. That is indeed what they say, that religious truth is different. Religious truth is personal truth. It's I-thou truth. It's existential truth. It's not factual correspondence type truth. But you can have personal truth without truth being personal. Because a person can correspond to reality just as well as a proposition can correspond to reality. Just because the Bible says that Jesus declared, I am the truth, doesn't mean that truth is itself personal. It means that that person corresponds to the truth. So you can have your cake and eat it too. You don't have to deny the personal dimension of truth to deny the personal nature of truth.